We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, FM 90.9 HD2, and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Three New York City students who got to high school even though they couldn't read challenged the system and won. Hearing officers for the school system ruled in the students' favor and said the city would have to pay for private tutoring for the students, who are now young adults. This afternoon, we'll hear their stories. Our guest is public radio reporter Beth Fertig. She is the author of Why Can't You Teach Me to Read? Three Students and a Mayor Put Our Schools to the Test. The book focuses on Yamilka, Alejandro, and Antonio. All three have learning disabilities. The book also focuses on the struggles our schools face and questions about how best to teach students to read. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls this afternoon for our guest, Beth Fertig. You can join the conversation with your questions and comments. I look forward to hearing from you. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Beth Fertig is a senior reporter for WNYC in New York and a regular contributor to NPR. Her reporting on the New York City public schools earned her the Alfred I. DuPont Columbia University Award. Her book, Why Can't You Teach Me to Read, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers if you'd like to join our discussion this afternoon. Beth Fertig, welcome.
Thank you so much, Celeste.
My pleasure to speak with you. The difficulties of illiteracy are evident from the first page of your book, when we see Yamilka, a now 20-something young woman, trying to get home from school on the subway. Would you tell the story?
Sure. I met Yamilka when I did a series for WNYC in 2006 on the very low graduation rate for students with learning disabilities. And it was really shockingly low, something like 20% of New York City students in special education programs were getting real high school diplomas. And the reason I say shockingly low is because the comparison for the rest of the state was 50%. And that's about what it is nationally. Now, you may think, oh, they're in special education, they can't do the same coursework. But that's really not true. Most students in special education have either learning disabilities or emotional problems or some physical problems. They're not mentally retarded. Very, very small proportion are. And even students who are mentally retarded are, for the most part, able to learn to read something. So to hear that a woman had graduated the New York City high schools with a special ed diploma, which doesn't demand very much because it's a special ed diploma, knowing only 8 letters of the alphabet, was really, really shocking to me when I met her. I met her through her attorney. There's a nonprofit law firm in New York City called Advocates for Children, which represents a lot of children who have issues with the New York City public schools and, you know, need a lawyer to push for what they need or some guidance. But in this case, if you're a student with a learning disability, you're entitled by federal law to a free and appropriate public education. A lot of parents don't know that or don't realize that they can get their children evaluated and tested. So you wind up sometimes, and I say sometimes because this is a pretty extreme case, with children who may get pretty far along knowing very little. So that's a long way of telling you how I met Yamilka. When I met her, She was living, she continues to live in the Bronx with her family. They're a Dominican family. The parents moved here about 15 or 20 years ago, as many Dominican immigrants did in the 1980s and 90s, hoping for a better life. They had no formal education themselves. And their children, they had four children, had very little education too. You know, they came here quite young. And Yamilka, it turned out, had a learning disability. And so did her brother, Alejandro. And they were both enrolled in their neighborhood public school when they were, you know, young children. And unfortunately, nobody figured out that they had learning disabilities. And they were just put in regular English as a second language classes. And it took about 4 years to figure out that Yamilka was not reading in either English or Spanish. And, you know, this is one of the many lapses that, you know, finally allowed her to win her case. But she had gotten all the way through the city school system, being bumped around in special education classes, even though she couldn't read, and was allowed to graduate not knowing how to read because the city gave her a special ed diploma, which is basically saying, you know, do whatever goals we have set for you. And it can be very, very little, these goals. It could be, you know, brushing your teeth or, you know, just learning how to spell the alphabet if they think a child is not capable of more. And that's how she was able to graduate. And she was in a very sad situation, staying at home, feeling like she couldn't really do anything because she couldn't read. She didn't think she could get any kind of job. Her family was supporting her, so it wasn't, you know, a dire emergency economically. But she told me that she felt like she didn't even want to go to her graduation ceremony. She said, why should I pay money on a cap and gown when they haven't taught me anything? And her mother said, I felt like going just so I could scream, my daughter doesn't even read. Because, you know, the mother felt horrible about what had happened and that she didn't know sooner that she could have, you know, fought for her daughter and done more to help her and her son as well, Alejandro, who had wound up in high school not reading. And luckily, somebody steered him to an attorney along the way, and that's how he found out that he was entitled to get more evaluations, more services. And the two of them together persuaded the city to compensate them. It's an educational award of tutoring funded by the city to make up for them not getting a real education. They were given a compensatory education. And Yamilka won what we believe is the single largest settlement ever. It was 1,500 hours of tutoring at city expense, which is, you know, about $90 an hour. So she won about $120,000 worth of tutoring. And her brother, he won, I'd like to say, almost 2,000 hours because it came in two chunks, two different settlements. So that's why his wound up being higher than hers in total. But it was pretty astonishing, you know, this admission of educational neglect by the city to say, you know, okay, yeah, we'll pay for the tutoring.
Yeah. And now the story that I really want you to tell, though, is now she's on her way home from a tutoring session.
Oh, right.
At school. And I was so moved by this story because it tells me if you can't read, you are lost.
Right, right. Well, she had, at that point, she was still in the tutoring program. So she's, you know, in her early 20s going to this program at Huntington Learning Center. And they're teaching her the alphabet and they're teaching her, you know, some basic first grade kindergarten type of words. But she lives in the Bronx and the tutoring center is in Manhattan on the Upper East Side. It's like maybe a half hour subway ride away. And she had left a little later than usual. She, you know, it was July, it was the summertime. And she had one of her teachers had given her like a free pass to her gym so that she could go, you know, and work out a little bit after class. So she went to the gym and then she went to the subway station. And as it often happens in New York, trains are diverted for track construction happening. You know, they'll say, we're going to miss the stop. You get off at the next one and go backwards. So she knows exactly which stops to get on and off of because she has a pretty limited sight word vocabulary, words that she sees and that she knows. So she knew that she needs to get off the train at 86th Street to go to her tutoring and she needs to, you know, return home. She gets off at a stop called Mount Eden in the Bronx. Well, the train went by Mount Eden because of track work. And then it took her someplace else. And she didn't really know what to do. She stayed on the train because she couldn't read the sign, you know, she couldn't read the map. She doesn't know that if you miss a stop or two, you can go back because that completely goes past her. She can't look at the map and read the names of the stations and realize, you know, what to do. She's also very afraid in a situation like this. She didn't know what to do. And she felt too ashamed of her illiteracy to speak out and ask somebody for help. So she wound up getting off the train. And I think she just sort of thought she'll take I know what it was. She figured out that she should go backwards. You know, she should go back toward Manhattan. But she didn't know what was happening. And she missed her stop to get off home. And then she kept going. And I think she was sort of thinking in her head, well, I'll just start all over again and go back to the tutoring center. Mm. But she missed that stop, which, as I talked to her, I was trying to figure out, you know, looking at the subway map where she went. She got off in Midtown. We think she must have gotten off like around 59th Street in Midtown Manhattan. And it seems like she probably walked and took a bus, thinking, I'm just going to get on a bus and hope that that takes me in the right direction. But it didn't take her in the right direction. It took her in the exact opposite direction, because she wound up going, from what she described to me, I was, you know, she couldn't read the signs. So I'm saying to her, Yamilko, what did people look like? And she said, well, they're all wearing suits. They were all white people. And I said, I think you wound up at Wall Street, as we were talking about the bus route. Mm. So she got back on a bus and she went uptown thinking, okay, this bus is going to Harlem. I know that's closer to the Bronx at least. So she's riding the bus and she gets off and she's, again, completely confused about where she is and doesn't want to ask for help. And I said, why didn't you ask for help? And she said, well, I didn't want to admit that I was illiterate, because then somebody could take advantage of me. So she ends up taking more buses. She tried to call home at one point. I think the payphone ate her quarter. She carries all of her quarters for the buses because she doesn't always have – we have Metro cards in New York. And if you don't have enough rides on them, you're going to use it up and it'll be useless. So she always carries extra quarters with her for the bus. And so she was afraid of using up her quarters to call home because she needed them to take the bus. Yes. And yet she's afraid to ask the bus driver for directions. So she just keeps riding buses basically around Harlem and the Bronx until she finds one that takes her to a familiar looking subway stop. And then she goes home because she realized where she was and that subway stop would take her home. But this took 6 hours. Yeah. And her family was looking for her. They went to the school. They you know, were looking around the neighborhood. They were panicking. And when she got home at midnight, they were so relieved. But she was so traumatized that it took her about a week to go back to school because she just felt so awful.
Yeah. How is it that a student like Yamilka can be cannot be noticed that she has a problem for 4 years in a school?
Well, this is –
Or
this
in
is what
schools.
Yeah. It sounds really shocking. And this is what I started to explain at the beginning, and New York City has over 1 million students, right? If New York City's public school system was a city, it would be the 9th or 8th largest city in the United States. It has, you know, over 1 million students, a couple hundred thousand teachers and principals and other faculty working there. So, yeah, you can slip through the cracks in New York City, especially if you're not a greasy wheel, if your parents aren't, you know, fighting for you as more educated middle class parents will do who know the system. Here she had like a triple whammy. She was from another country. Her parents not only didn't speak the language, but they didn't have an education themselves. They had very, very little schooling. They grew up where her mother had to basically work cleaning houses starting, you know, when she was in elementary school to help pay the bills. Her father really never went to school. It turns out her father had dyslexia too and didn't learn to read in Spanish. So this whole world of schooling is completely foreign to them. And then, you know, you're supposed to catch children like this by figuring out that they need special education. And ideally, that's what would happen. But Yamilka also happened to wind up in what was, at the time, probably one of the worst districts in the New York City public school system. In the Bronx, this district was known for having really, really wretched schools with extremely low graduation rates, low test scores. And it was just sort of a dumping ground, I think. And she, you know, literally was that child who fell through every crack possible. And the same thing happened with her brother. They were going to the same schools. And so I think, you know, as I talked to her and I looked over her educational records, it seemed like every once in a while a teacher would notice and maybe pull her out of the classroom and say, you know, I want to give you some help. But then she wouldn't get sent to the type of special education class that could help her with her specific problems, so that the school system will say you have a learning disability, which is a very broad term, mm-hmm. and not do the full battery of tests that you might pay for if you had the money to find out exactly what type of learning disability. Is it dyslexia? Well, you need a neurological test to determine that, and that's more comprehensive and more expensive. So the city will just say it doesn't really matter what type of learning disability. Ideally, the teacher should be able to work with it. Well, then you wind up in a situation where you're in a special education class with fewer students than a regular classroom. So instead of 25 to 30, you have 12 or 15 students. But those students may all have completely different needs. Some of them may be emotionally disturbed. Some of them may be mentally retarded. Some of them may be, well, the mentally retarded children would actually wind up in a much smaller classroom usually. But my point is they would have different learning needs in this classroom. And one teacher may not know the exact type of interventions to give a child like Yamilka, who's having an especially hard time and couldn't even get the sounds of the letters because she had a language disorder, that if they had done the right testing, they would have figured out that she needed speech therapy, which they do for lots of little children when they're not getting the sounds of the letters. So it was just a really bad luck situation where she never got the help that she needed at any step of the process. And at high school, I think, they finally just sort of gave up and sent her to it's called a career development school, but it's really for children who are in a special category of special education where the system says these are the most needy students. Some of these are kids who are in hospitals getting an education. Mm-hmm. Some of them are mentally retarded. Some of them have, extreme learning disabilities. And so they don't have very high expectations for these children. And they'll figure, let's just sort of teach them life skills, how to balance a checkbook. So they sent Yamilka to a high school that does career development, life skills types of things. But she was I think she got like a little bit of class every day, and then she was sent to a hospital where she would take out the trash or work with children. But it was very minimal educational engagement for her, and they had no expectations for her. And so that's how she was allowed to graduate, knowing nothing.
Yeah. How many students with surmountable learning disabilities are given up on?
You know, it's a really hard thing to figure out because not all of them will show up. They will drop out of the school system. Mm-hmm. They will, maybe bounce along and get a special ed diploma, and you'll never know if they could have gotten more. The Advocates for Children, the group that represented Yamilka and her brother Alejandro, they say, you know, sadly, these kids aren't alone. You know, yeah, they're pretty extreme cases, but we see cases like this every year. The tutoring center that she went to and her brother went to, a different one in Manhattan, which is, you know, did a very, very good job, by the way. I should, you know, we could talk about this later, but her brother did really well. They'll say that they've told me that any year they'll have 10 to 15% of their clients are coming from the New York City public school system, paying for them to get services while they're either in school or while they've, you know, because they've left school and they still need help. So, you know, we're talking maybe a few hundred a year. The city didn't have any data who are going to private tutoring centers at taxpayer expense. But then there's other students who win what's called, they win special waivers that allow them to go to private schools for children with learning disabilities, some of which are very, very good, and they charge $30,000 to $40,000 a year, and the city and the state will pay for them if they can prove that their needs are not being met in the regular New York City public schools, and there's a whole thing you have to go through to do that. So once again, somebody like Yamilka, whose family didn't know the system, wouldn't have known that she could take advantage of that program. I think, you know, to get back to your question of how many kids wind up in this situation, the only way of really measuring it would be to look at maybe the dropout rate and to also look at the test scores. So when Mayor Bloomberg took office in 2002, about 18% or 17% of the city's third through eighth graders were reading at the bottom level in New York State, which really was meaning they couldn't read at all. The city, to its credit, has developed more reading interventions, and part of No Child Left Behind meant focusing more on different categories of students and more testing. And, you know, even though a lot of people complain about No Child Left Behind for a variety of reasons, one thing it did do, which most people will agree upon, is that it forced teachers to pay attention to different groups of students. Hey, how are our special education mm-hmm. students doing? How are our English language learners doing? So that they don't just say, oh, well, overall, 60% of our kids met the state standard. They'd have to say, oh, look, there's an achievement gap here of white kids doing well, but Hispanic kids not doing as well, or special education kids doing really poorly. And what can we do to focus on that? So I think the fact that so many children were testing at that bottom level meant that there certainly were many, many more children who weren't able to read or barely able to read. It's been reduced. If it was around 18% when Bloomberg took office, it's now just about 3%. But 3% in a city with, you know, a million public school students is still tens of thousands of students who are reading below grade level. And that's the other big point of this book, is that these are extreme cases, but there's many, many more children who are not learning to read at the level that we expect in the 21st century.
Yeah. So these three people that you focus on, Yamilka, Alejandro, and Antonio, who we really haven't talked about yet.
Oh, yeah. He's a character.
Yeah. And he's not 7:30. But no. We'll talk about that in a minute. But these three stories tell us something about the bigger picture about getting all kids to read.
Yeah. They're kind of like canaries in the coal mine. You know, if you have cases like this that can pass through, that tells you that there's something wrong in the system, that you're not catching everyone. Now, certainly, that some of that's going to happen anywhere. You know, all teachers say that there's always going to be a few tragedies here and there. Our job is to try to minimize them and get as little as possible, obviously. But, you know, when so many students, when you had 18% of the city's students reading at the bottom level, that was clearly a sign that that was out of whack with what your population is. There's very few students who can't learn to read. You know, there's reading experts who say that most children are going to learn to read no matter what you do for them. But there are estimates that possibly 20% of students have some sort of reading problem like dyslexia. And most of those are going to get better with a little extra help. But then maybe another few percent are going to need really intensive tutoring or intensive classes, segregated classes perhaps in the most intensive cases. But there is a percentage of the population, you know, special education students make up 10, 12% of the population in public schools, and more than half of those have learning disabilities. And the vast majority of those kids have reading problems. So we're talking, you know, 4, 5, 6% of public school students and probably the population at large who have reading problems. And if you get them the help that they need soon enough, then they'll be okay, or at least they'll have some degree of reading. But if you don't, then you wind up with situations like this. And, you know, a student should not have to go through a whole fair hearing process in order to learn how to read is what these attorneys will tell you and the children themselves.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Beth Fertig. She's a senior reporter for WNYC in New York and a regular contributor to NPR. And she is the author of Why Can't You Teach Me to Read? Three Students and a Mayor Put Our Schools to the Test. Three New York City students who got to high school, even though they couldn't read, challenged the system, and one hearing officers for the school system ruled in the students' favor and said the city would have to pay for private tutoring for the students who are now young adults. We're talking with Beth Fertig this afternoon about their stories and the struggles our schools face and questions about how best to teach students to read. Those are all on the agenda here this afternoon on the program. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call from a listener waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I've got a question for your guest. Now, if I ask a question or make a comment, can we go back and forth, or do you always just cut people off when they say something?
Well, what I try and do is I don't like to cut people off.
Well,
but
so if I ask or make a comment, can I get an answer from your guest?
Yes, and then we'll get a follow-up from you. Fair
okay.
enough?
Okay, yes, fair
okay.
enough. Now, as a parent, my children are late 30s and 40 now, but if they had gone to school and couldn't read, it would have been my fault, not the school's fault. Now, why isn't the parents responsible for the teaching the children to read, other than the school system, all the way to high school, and then they sue and all this and that?
Well, it's a good question. And obviously, every child should have a parent like you who has their back and is paying attention to what's going on in school. But unfortunately, there are some children who don't have that situation.
Well, therefore, they can sue, and the school, the taxpayers, have to teach them how to read. I have four grandchildren, and before they ever started even into preschool, they could almost read. They can write their name. And I'm just confused as to why anyone should be able to do that without the parent being responsible, not the school.
I'll just explain to you legally what the law says.
I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Oh, okay. The federal law says that if you have a disability, you're entitled to a free and appropriate public education. So children with disabilities are in a separate rights group right away. So this couldn't happen with every child. If you have a disability and you're entitled to a free and appropriate public education and you find that you're not getting it, which is what happened to Yamilka and her brother and Antonio, who we'll talk about some more, then you're entitled to say, look, you know, I feel like my needs aren't being met. School isn't doing right by me. I'm not learning to read, or I'm not getting, you know, whatever help I need. And then the city or the state or whatever the district is has to come up with a solution. Yamilka, unfortunately, it was too late. She had already graduated high school, so they compensated her with private tutoring. Her brother, Alejandro, when he brought his case, he was 19, 20. So it was kind of too late for him to really finish up in school. So that's why he won private settlement as a compensation as well. But your question is really about what is the role of parents? And what I would say is it's a tough question. You know, ideally, yes, you can hold these parents accountable and say those parents should have been doing more. And I've interviewed their parents and they are heartbroken. Believe me, if they could do it all over again, they would have been at that school every day demanding more. But they were immigrants. They didn't speak the language. They didn't know the culture. And honestly, they tell me that they did go to school and they said, I don't think my child's learning. And they were told, oh, it'll get better. We're going to put them in a different class and it'll be better next year. So they were sort of complaining along the way. And especially Antonio, who we haven't talked about, he's the youngest of the three. His mom went to school or went to the school district office every year and said, my son isn't learning. What's happening? And he was the troublemaker kid. You know, he was a difficult kid. He had ADD, you know, attention deficit disorder. He also had dyslexia. And I think the schools kept moving him around, hoping the problem would go away because the kid was transferred to 11 different schools over a 12-year period. So she was asking for help, but they told her, you know, the solution is to transfer him. And obviously, at each step of the way, something went wrong. We don't know exactly what, but he apparently didn't get the help that he needed, which is why he won private tutoring to supplement him while he was still going to high school. He was still a student when this happened. But, you know, unfortunately, not all children have parents who can really fight for them. And then the question becomes, if you think that it's a waste of taxpayer dollars to pay for these students to get tutoring, and that's a valid point, then you have to ask yourself, are we going to end up paying for them somehow later? And the prison population is full of children with or people with learning disabilities. I've seen estimates that up to a third of the juvenile population in prison has learning disabilities. The unemployment rate is extremely high for people with learning disabilities. So if we don't pay attention to this problem while they're in school, the argument goes we're going to end up paying for it quite dearly later on. So it's cheaper to give them an education in school, even if we have to pay extra for the tutoring, perhaps, than for them to wind up on unemployment or go to jail.
Okay. Let's take another call. A listener on a cell phone on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, I'm hoping that my cell phone stays connected. It got disconnected a little while ago. I have a couple of comments and possibly a question. The situations that are being described here are actually quite complicated because there's an interaction between English language learners, students coming from other countries, parents who have limited English or no English experiences in facilitating their child's education, and the interface with learning disabilities. And one of the problems with assessment for that is that trying to determine whether it's a learning disability versus cultural and environmental disadvantages that have complicated matters is one thing. And then further, there's also a lot of times a mistaken notion that there's something special about the evaluation for dyslexia, that there's a requirement of neurological testing, and that's not exactly true.
Okay. And do you have a question?
Well, I guess the question really relates to, and I guess without actually having, you know, read about, you know, the specific cases, you know, what kinds of comments come from sort of those complications for these cases?
Well, yeah, these are obviously three very complicated cases, and you're right that it's the interface, as you say, between them being children who are not native English speakers. Although Antonio is a native English speaker, I should say. He grew up in a household where Spanish was spoken, but he also spoke English as a child. That obviously makes it much more complicated, and it's difficult for teachers to sort out all of these issues. And you're also right that there's a debate over whether you do neurological tests to prove that a student has dyslexia or you just do the standard battery of, you know, reading tests, because it doesn't matter in the end what you call it. You still have to treat it. And treat the child as though they have, you know, figure out what sort of reading methods are going to help them. But I guess what I would say is that these, you know, these being three extremely hard luck cases, there are many students in this country who are coming from other countries and their parents don't speak English, and teachers have to figure out on a daily basis if they're struggling, whether it's because of a language issue, as you're saying, or if it's because of you know, culture issue, maybe they've never been in school before, or if it's a genuine learning disability. Schools, that's their job, is to figure it out. It shouldn't take 4 years for a school to figure that out, as it did with, you know, with Yamilka. But there's also, you don't want to be too cautious, I guess is what I'm hearing from principals, is that they feel like their hands are tied a little bit in New York mm-hmm. because they're told to wait, see if it's a language issue, when that could actually end up holding them back, because maybe they should be finding a special education type of program for the child right away. But one thing I do want to say, which is this is something that's coming up nationally in the conversation right now, is one way to avoid the catastrophes or the reading problems later on, which are associated more often, unfortunately, with children who are coming from families that not only don't speak English but are not reading to their child early. There have been many studies showing that children who are from low-income families whose parents do not read to them and give them all the advantages of a middle-class family will have a sufficient gap in their readiness for school. One study, a very famous study that was done in the 1980s, found that a child from, you know, a middle-class, college-educated family goes to school with a vocabulary that had 3 million more words, or has a vocabulary of about 3 million words, or they've heard 3 million utterances. That's the more correct phrase. They don't have the vocabulary of 3 million words, but they have heard 3 million words by the time they're 3 years old or 4 years old and going to school. Whereas the child from the poor family, whose parents are not educated, has heard only 1 million utterances and words. So right away, that means that that child from a poor family, from a family that doesn't speak English, isn't reading to them, is more likely to arrive in kindergarten with an enormous gap in their language development, so that it makes it harder for them to keep up as they're getting older. And that's something that reading teachers are dealing with right now, is they're saying maybe what we should be doing is having more intensive reading programs early on in kindergarten and first grade for everybody, so that it's like giving a preventative medicine almost to those kids who are going to be struggling, and it'll prevent them from having to go to special education classes later. And there are studies showing that there's some promise in this. The program is called Response to Intervention. That's the name for these types of reading programs, where it's like extra intensive phonics and reading exercises when kids are in kindergarten and first grade that can hopefully reduce special education placements.
Does Elizabeth go ahead?
The response to intervention model is really a simply renaming of something that school psychology was focusing on for the past 40 years called consultation-based service. And the idea is that school psychologists in particular would work with teachers, principals, and students in trying to prevent and to remediate early difficulties that they might see. And the first part of any RTI or response to intervention model requires that the first instruction, the general curriculum, and what the teachers are actually teaching to the students in the first place is research-based and addressing those factors. So in a sense that there's this this emphasis on sort of quality teaching in the first place, and then following up with those kids who are having some difficulties with that, providing them with that early intervention to try and nip at the bud, so to speak. But the point you were making about the language development for an advantage versus a disadvantaged youngster is one of the more essential kinds of factors that differentiate kids when they're coming to kindergarten and first grade, and that is, you know, kids from middle, upper middle class, and so on, are actually coming to school reading already. The teachers mm-hmm. don't necessarily have to teach them how to read, but the disadvantaged youths are actually coming behind, in a sense, not having those advantages, and so that's one of the components. But to go back to the three cases you were really talking about earlier, at what age was the young woman? When did they come to the United States from the Dominican Republic?
She was 10 years old, 9 or 10 years old, and one more complication, which I'll throw in now. When she was in the Dominican Republic, her parents left with the two older siblings and left her behind with her brother to stay with a relative. This relative was supposed to put them in school and was given money for their school supplies and unfortunately pocketed the money and did not put them in school and hid that from the family. So for 2 years, these children, when they should have been entering school, did not. So they had an interrupted education on top of it.
Right.
Now, it's just – that's why I'm saying, like, they had every bad luck scenario imaginable. But that still doesn't – you know, their attorneys would say that doesn't relieve the school system of its burden to figure out that something happened. And especially when you go and you look at their individualized education programs, which is special education students get this document saying what their individual education program is going to be, you know, what their assessments are showing and what they're capable of and what the schools should try to teach them, you know. These documents all said that. They all said she has an interrupted education. Oh, she's testing this way. Oh, it doesn't appear she can learn to read. She only knows a few letters. So they were noticing these problems, but they never did anything about it. So it was documented throughout her case, which is why she won the settlement. And it was the same thing with the other two. You know, this people along the way were noticing. There were school psychologists and teachers who said, yeah, I can't help her. I need more help. I need one-on-one attention with this girl. And nobody ever came to their rescue.
Right. Yeah, I mean, those are obviously, you know, the sort of tragedies. But from an assessment standpoint, to know, is this a learning disability, you know, in terms of reading, which is sort of the dyslexia, you know, definition, or, you know, is this a student who, because of maybe limited language experiences, their parents not having the educational experiences and so on, were cognitive abilities impaired to some extent, not mentally retarded, but not quite normal either, the interrupted education. And so these are all complicating factors that preclude a diagnosis of learning disability in the context of mm-hmm. the U.S. public schools, because the disability or the discrepancy between what they're achieving and what they would be expected to achieve is based upon, well, what's their intellectual abilities, which is complicated because of the fact they're coming from another country, another educational system, another culture, and so on, really complicates it. Is it, in a sense, this interface between language and interrupted education that has compromised her abilities in school versus something that is implied, something about the kid that is
right.
She
certainly had a whole bunch of issues going on that were only discovered later after she went for tutoring. And it was really extraordinary to me because I didn't know very much about learning disabilities. You know, I'm pretty much a layperson who covers the city's public schools, but I don't know about specific learning disabilities like I did as I got to know these children or these young people now. And it turned out that she cannot hear rhymes. If you say to her, bat, cat, do those rhyme? She won't always be able to tell you. That's a language disability, a specific kind of problem processing sounds. So if she can't hear those sounds, she can't associate them with letters when she looks at the letters. And that is what made it so hard for her to learn how to read. If they'd caught her when she was, you know, 5 or because she didn't come to New York till she was 10, if they'd caught her at 9 or 10 when she first came to school, they would have had a lot more hope of helping her than as a 25-year-old woman now. So this is the type of thing that our public schools are presented with because they can't turn any child away. They have all these different types of cases coming to them. They have children of all different abilities. And what you're seeing right now with this move toward standardized assessments, measuring which teachers are most effective, the standards movement that we saw with No Child Left Behind, testing students, making sure schools are educating all students, not just, you know, your middle-class kids, making sure that they also reach the poor, the Hispanics, the English language learners, every category of child. That movement's not going away. A lot of people are upset with No Child Left Behind, and the Obama administration doesn't want to call it that anymore, but they are not backing off from the push to test, to assess, to reward school districts that use data to figure out which teachers are more effective. That's what some of the federal stimulus money is going to be going to in the coming months. New York State is going to be applying for that. I'm sure Illinois, other states are going to be applying for that. Arne Duncan from Chicago is a big supporter of measuring teacher quality with tests, seeing if standardized tests and other forms of watching teachers can make them more effective, because there are studies showing that the best teachers are going to make all the difference, especially with kids who are disadvantaged. So these are really hard policy questions for this nation to solve. And our reading scores are going to come out in January from the latest 2009 National Assessment of Educational Progress. Not a lot of people are predicting a big change from 2007, when 25% of our eighth graders were reading at the bottom level. That meant they couldn't even read for basic information or understand the main idea of a paragraph. The United States is facing huge competition from other developed nations that have much higher levels of literacy than we do. And that's pretty shocking. You know, we think we have a 99% or almost 100% literacy rate, but levels of literacy are different. Do you want functional literacy, or do you want literacy meaning you can actually work in a factory and read the manuals and read the text on the screen? It's a much higher level of literacy that is demanded in this economy right now than ever before, when people could go to factories and just push buttons. It's a text-based world right now.
What does it mean to be literate in the 21st century?
That's, you know, that's something that we're going to have to wrestle with as a nation. But is it to be, you know, functional? The No Child Left Behind law changed our expectations, obviously, for all students. You know, we never would have, years before, expected students like this to be tested, right? So do you want to lower the bar? Do you want to raise the bar? These are the questions that we have to deal with. Now, I'm going in my book to look this up. In 2005, there was a survey of seven countries and regions by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And it found that 20% of American adults are functionally illiterate, which ranked the United States fifth behind Norway, Bermuda, Canada, and Switzerland. It was ahead of Italy and a region of Mexico. They were studying these different places to see what levels of literacy adults had attained. Now, the adults who were functionally illiterate, that didn't mean that they couldn't read at all. What it meant was they had difficulty making low-level text-based inferences, according to the organization. And the U.S. government conducted its own assessment of adult literacy in 2003, which found that between 12 and 20% of respondents were at the lowest of three different types of reading tests. So if you scored at the bottom, you had a hard time summarizing a want ad, a magazine article, seeing if your car had enough gas to get to the next station. The U.S. defined literacy as using printed and written information to function in society, to achieve one's goals, and to develop one's knowledge and potential. So that's a standard. But do we also then expect, you know, our states to have every child functioning at the best level possible and, you know, universal literacy, college readiness? President Obama talks about you owe it to yourself to graduate high school and to go on to college. Students should graduate high school being college ready. Well, clearly not every student is going to reach that goal, but that is a goal for the nation. And that's why I'm saying it's going to be a serious discussion with the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind and looking at what the standards really should be.
Yeah. Boy, the time has just flown by. I've got to wrap up here, and I've got a couple of callers I'm just not going to be able to get to this afternoon. My apologies for that. But before we go, I do want to ask you, Beth, you know, we've got the Internet, Twitter, Facebook, MySpace. These are so important in the lives of so many, most young people, I would say. Do these technologies provide motivation to read?
I would say it cuts both ways. There are teachers who complain all the time that, oh, the kids, their grammar is horrible. Yeah. They're using, you know, shorthand from when they do the texting. But Antonio was a great example of how the internet can be helpful. Antonio is the kid who got transferred to another school every year, and he won about 500 hours of tutoring. He went from like maybe a kindergarten to a fifth grade reading level in about 8 months of tutoring. He ended up dropping out of high school. He wasn't very motivated. He felt really down about the whole situation. But he had learned enough reading to be able to participate on the internet. And like a lot of teenagers, he went on MySpace because he heard all the kids were doing it and he wanted to meet girls. So suddenly he's on MySpace interacting with kids in his zip code in Washington Heights in Upper Manhattan. And then he gets a new cell phone, which has the keyboard on it. So he's able to text people all the time. So he's got the motivation and he's not intimidated by a big page. It's just a little text screen. And he starts writing more and more and more. And he's able to navigate the internet and send text messages to people. So he took what he learned from his tutoring to get to a higher level of literacy. He passed the test to work at UPS. It's not a very high level of literacy, but he's loading boxes at UPS in Queens. And now he's hoping to go back and get more tutoring and hopefully get a GED if he can.
And 730
so
is
can a, be helpful.
730 is slang for...
730 was his nickname on the streets in Washington Heights. It's from the New York Penal Code. It's 730 is the term for a crazy person. Yeah. Antonio is, you know, he's a talker. He likes to talk to people. And, you know, so some of the kids on the street were nicknaming him 730. He didn't like that nickname, but kind of stuck with him. But, you know, he's shown what he's capable of doing now. He really stuck with it. And he's gotten quite far, you know, for somebody who, you know, really only started learning to read when he was 17 years old, 18 years old. The other two, Alejandro, when he got the right reading instruction, which is very, it's called a multi-sensory instruction when they teach kids to feel the words in their mouth, use their fingers to draw them out. This is how to, you know, work with dyslexia, visualize the letters, visualize the words. He went from a kindergarten to ninth grade reading level in 2.5 years. And he would really love to go to college. He's very, very intellectually capable. And I would say gifted because he's learned so much from watching television. He could talk to me all about Carl Sagan and string theory and stuff. And, you know, he understands all that. But he can't read very fast and he can't write very well. And his math is still very poor. So that's holding him back as he tries to go to college because he needs to take the GED and he's having a hard time. Yamilka is still really affected by these learning disabilities. It's made it very hard for her to progress as quickly as the other two because of this problem with the rhyming and matching the sounds to the letters. She progressed much more once she got the help that she needed, and she has some sight words now. She can read at, you know, first grade level, but it's reading is different for her than for other people because of these handicaps that she has. So she's hoping to be able to maybe, you know, learn how to cook in a kitchen or something like that where she can get just enough sight skills to be able to learn and to get a job. But it's very sad for her because she wants to read books so badly.
And there we got to wrap up. We're out of time. Beth, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Beth Furtick is a senior reporter for WNYC in New York. She is the author of Why Can't You Teach Me to Read? The book is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And our thanks this afternoon to engineer Bill O'Neill there at WNYC for his help this afternoon.